This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Deandra Rose has always been 10 steps ahead of her peers. By the time she was in first grade, she'd already developed a strong interest in government and politics. She won every student council election from first to eighth grade, except for one year when she lost by one vote because she refused to vote for herself. Deandra made the cheerleading squad in high school, despite her peers' comments that black girls don't do cheerleading. And she became a campaign manager for a statewide political race before she finished high school. She also dabbled in the pageant world and was the second black woman in history to hold the Miss University of Georgia title. At 31, she's a professor at Duke Sanford School of Public Policy. She studies the impact of landmark higher education programs like Pell Grants and Title IX. Deandra Rose joins me today to talk about her life on and off the stage. Deandra, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's so nice to be here.
Let's talk about those early years. You were a tiny little baby when you were born in Cleveland.
I was. So I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and my family lived in Shaker Heights, this little suburb outside of Cleveland. And I was born to teen parents. So my mom was 17 years old when she had me, and my dad, I believe he was about 18. And in addition to the challenges of being young parents, I was a premature baby. I came about 2 months early, and so I weighed 2 pounds when I was born. And, you know, so I hear these stories about how completely tiny I was. You could fit me in the palm of your hand. And I had these translucent little fingers and but a whole lot of hair, which is really funny. I've always had really big hair, but it was like this teeny tiny baby. I couldn't fit normal baby clothes, so they actually purchased doll clothes, you know, to feed, to dress me. And so I was in an incubator for the first few months of my life. And my mom, I don't know how she did it. She would, you know, she would get on the bus, actually, and go from the house in Shaker all the way down to the hospital in Cleveland where I was being incubated. And every day in the snow, in the rain, you know, whatever the weather called for, and she would go and she would sit with me. And she always tells the story of how the doctors told her that I would be severely impaired. You know, I probably wouldn't be able to keep up with the kids at school. I probably wouldn't, you know, have normal vision and hearing. I would be, you know, just, you know, I'd have a really rough time sometimes. And she always says how when she, every time the doctor ticked off something that I wouldn't be able to do, she would go, nope, you know what, she's going to be great at this. And so it's really interesting.
When did you first start hearing those stories?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, as long as I can remember, I've been aware of, you know, this sort of interesting arrival. And I do remember sort of, you know, responding to them like I was too cool for school at one point, like, oh, mom, you know, this is just so much drama, you know, and I'd hear them and, you know, I think, oh, that's kind of gross, clear fingers. But I mean, it was, I think as early as I could remember, I knew that I was this teeny tiny baby and they were so excited to have me there.
And your mom taking the bus, she was working too, right? I mean, this is...
So actually she was between school and jobs. Yeah. And so for her, it was really focusing on this new baby.
Right. And your grandmother also played an important part in your life.
Oh,
yes. Tell us about your relationship with her.
Yeah. So I grew up in a family of very, very strong, very glamorous women, actually. And so my grandmother, when I was born, was 37. And so she, along with my mom, I mean, it was sort of like this interesting co-parenting. And so my grandmother actually went to college in her 40s. She decided to go into a nursing program. And so my earliest memories are sitting in bed with my grandmother on Saturday mornings. We were studying. We were doing our homework. And so she had these huge nursing texts. And I would have, you know, whatever ABC book I'm reading. Of course, mine would be upside down.
Right.
But, you know, and then my mom, my aunt, my uncle would come in and tease us and they'd say, oh, you know, honey, you study long, you study wrong. And I just, you know, and my grandmother would say, oh, don't tease her, leave her alone. But, you know,
that's
for
amazing.
Me, that was cool.
But you're both studying. You're both studying for, you
oh,
know,
yes.
And getting ready for school. And you lost your father to an accident at an early age, right?
I did. So my dad, he was, you know, by all, and again, a lot of this is through stories, the memories, because he passed away when I just turned 3. And so I have very fleeting memories of him, but he was a Marine. And so sometimes people ask, how did I get interested in government and politics? And I can't help but wonder if it has to do with some of the early imagery. You know, at his funeral, there was, you know, the flag folding and all of that. But he also, interestingly, he, from all stories, he was a very clever, smart guy, and he was really good at fixing things. You know, I think he was an electrician, and so actually he passed away. He was working on a restaurant sign and tragically fell. But he seemed, by all accounts, was just this amazing, sparkling personality.
So you've got these women around you, your mom, your grandmother, who's studying to become a nurse, and I assume that was successful.
Yes, she did.
You were in charge of, then you had two younger sisters after that, right?
Yes. So my two younger sisters, Mercedes and Brandy, I love them. We have just such an interesting relationship because we're very different. And so they're 11 months apart in birth. And so they were thick as thieves, you know, for all the years of growing up. And I'm about 4.5 and 5.5 years older than them. And so growing up, you know, my mom was a single parent. By this time, we'd moved to Atlanta. And so I really took on a lot of responsibility with helping at home. And so it's really interesting. I mean, so many stories of Mercedes and Brandy. Like with the two of them, we would just go at it.
Ganging up on you.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I remember one time, you know, during summer, you know, oftentimes I would take care of the kids during summer times, and they would just, I mean, we would go back and forth. I have to admit, I had it coming. So I would, you know, hide around a corner and jump out at them and, oh, Deandra. And so one day I remember I was cooking and I had my back to the rest of the apartment. And I was on the phone chatting with one of my friends, like, you know, can you believe that so-and-so, da-da-da-da-da. And I remember I'm turning, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this really big man in the apartment. And I'm, like, freaking out. And I turn, I do a double take, and I scream, and the phone goes one way, and the spatula goes another way. And all of a sudden, I hear this high-pitched laughing, like, you know, ha-ha-ha, like this operatic laughing. And it was one sister had put the other sister on her shoulders. And apparently, we had an uncle who visited, and he had a top coat and a hat. And I mean, it was just the scariest thing. But I mean, to this day, they'll still, like, cry from laughing.
They get a lot of points just for pulling that off.
Totally. And a lot of respect from me, I'll say.
You, on the other hand, were a precocious child all by yourself. So while that stunt may have fooled you, not much else did. And you had this interest in politics and government like from first grade, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't know how it came about, but somehow we had classroom elections. And I decided, you know, I was somehow the designated person in first grade. And so every year after that, I became the student council representative. So from where I started school in Ohio, and then when we moved to Georgia, I did the same thing. And I remember, you know, I love the story of the fourth grade election, because it was just the fourth grade philosopher in grappling with whether it's appropriate to vote for oneself in an election. And so it was, you know, I remember these conversations with my friends, and it was like, of course you don't vote for yourself. How conceited is that? Yeah. And so I remember in hindsight, after the election, I lost by one vote, which was my vote for my best friend, which sort of suggested that she probably voted for herself, which was, you know, it made perfect sense.
Yeah. Well, see, from a public policy standpoint, if you truly believe in yourself and you're the best candidate, of course you do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I learned that lesson the hard way.
On the other hand, kind of from a socially acceptable point of view, which may have been more important to the fourth grader in you, that's just not a nice thing to do. So you did learn the lesson. Did you stay friends with the
women? Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. We stayed friends, went to high school. I made a comeback. But then it was, so eighth grade, actually, before high school, I ran for school president. And I remember at that time, my opponent was a friend of mine. We'd been friends for years, but all the girls thought that he looked like Leo DiCaprio. And this was on the heels of Titanic's release. And so I didn't have a prayer in the world. Like, it was just no hope. So I lost that one. It was a very public defeat, and it hurt.
Well, how much of it for you in those earlier years, anywhere along the way, was kind of a popularity contest? You'd want people to vote for you. And how much was public policy? Were you thinking about, you know, sort of getting root beer in the drinking fountains or whatever the issue was?
Absolutely both. Yeah. I mean, it was really the sense of being a leader and recognized as being able to have some measure of agency in the school and being able to listen to what the students wanted, be it more ice cream in the cafeteria or, you know, whatever was on their minds. I was really into that. And then I think it was sort of the sport of it all, you know, and I think that sort of, even looking more long term at the pageantry, there was some sportswomanship in it that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, a little bit competitive, a little bit public policy, and that evolves over time. And so before we get to the pageants in our break, you can tell us about learning violin, because that had a little tragic moment along the way.
Oh, yes. So fourth grade was a really big year for me. So I was also this very entrepreneurial kid. And so I always had these ideas. And at one point, I remember I had the bright idea to have like a carnival in the neighborhood. And we set up stations and had all the kids from the neighborhood and neighboring communities came. I made all this money. I had someone who was in charge of, and it was like, you know, 25 cents admission or something. And then the ice cream man came and we were robbed. All the kids just completely like ransacked the cash register. So I learned, you know, to value law and order in fourth grade. So also in fourth grade, I remember watching PBS. And
you were watching PBS in fourth grade?
Oh, loving it.
Maybe Sesame Street.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I also loved Anne of Green Gables, which they showed in Ohio on PBS over and over again. So at this point, I was watching Yanni at the Acropolis. And I remember being completely dazzled by Karen Briggs, the violinist. And so I wanted to be Karen Briggs. So I was obsessed with the violin. So, of course, in sixth grade, when I went to middle school and we had the opportunity to play an instrument, I took on violin.
We'll find out why that was a problem when our conversation continues with Duke Public Policy Professor Deandra Rose. Stay with us on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest, Duke Public Policy Professor Deandra Rose. As a scholar, she now studies the impact of landmark financial aid policies like Title IX and Pell Grants. Her early years were filled with politics of a different kind, and we were talking about learning to play the violin. You loved it. You wanted to play it.
Absolutely. Right. And so when I got the opportunity in sixth grade to learn an instrument, there was no question that I had to be a violinist. And so I remember it was dramatic, though, because in my school, we had access to cello and bass instruments. So you could rent one of those for the semester. But if you wanted to play violin or viola, you had to actually go out and rent one or buy one. And, you know, coming from this single parent family where money was often tight, and I it was a real stretch. So I'm thinking, you know, will my mom go for this? But I was really adamant. And my mom was wonderful. And she went out and she rented a violin. And I played that poor thing to death. I mean, we lived in an apartment, and I don't know how my neighbors, you know, they were obviously wonderful people because they never complained. I played it all the time. And my sisters were like, oh, Deandra, please stop, and all of that. And I remember one night I was practicing as always, and my sisters were supposed to be in bed, but somehow I was practicing near them, and I set the instrument down on the floor to go get some water or something like that. And I remember all of a sudden I hear just crack, ping, ping, ping. And sorry. And so one of the sisters had stepped on my violin, and it was just the end of my life as I knew it. I was just devastated. And I'm thinking, I'm never going to get another instrument. You know, these things are very expensive. And to my mom's infinite eternal credit, she went and bought me another violin. Like, I don't even know how I was, you know, I mean, so she paid off the first one that was broken and got me a second one. And so, also the drama of orchestra in middle school is especially, you know, gut-wrenching, you know, constantly dueling for first chair status. You know, I loved it.
So you were intense. Intensity will be the theme of this program. You take up politics from first grade and you get more and more serious about it. You take up the violin and you got very serious about that. Also, you know, and you give a lot of credit to your mother. Don't even understand how she could possibly have done what she was doing behind the scenes, right? I mean, I've heard you say that.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think a lot of the things that was interested in as a kid were very foreign to sort of, you know, our experience as a family. And so I remember, you know, I had a very busy schedule, and so I'd need to go to meetings very early. And I remember, you know, that additional stress on my mom had to be challenging. And so when I was in, I believe, goodness, I decided to become a cheerleader when I was in high school. And that was a really big sort of strange thing that required a lot of practices and money, you know, the uniform rental and all of this. And so I started my first job at the age of 14 in order to save money for these extracurricular activities. And so my first job was at Cece's Pizza. And so my friends were horrible people, and they would come to the restaurant. And, you know, there's this thing where I was the greeter. So whenever someone had to come into the restaurant, I had to say, "Hi, welcome to Cece's," you know, in a really loud, enthusiastic voice. Right. And I was like, it's practice for cheerleading. So Right. This is great. And so but then my friends would just they would come in and leave out and come in and leave out and just circle. So I'd have to say it over and over again. It's horrible people.
It's funny. It's funny now, isn't it?
Absolutely. Okay. Well, it still hurts a little now.
Still, I can imagine. But the cheerleader thing of this came as a surprise to me that you were sort of warned off. Tell me about that.
That wasn't my box. You know, I was actually seen as I was the student council kid. I was one of the smart kids. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've learned that oftentimes when what you intend to do blurs neat categories, oftentimes you'll get some resistance. And so in my high school, there was it was a very diverse school in a fabulous county in Georgia. But it was really interesting that there were certain things that you knew that you quote unquote should do or were eligible to do. And, you know, not by rules or anything, but it was just sort of social expectations. So, you know, minority young women were expected to maybe be on the dance team, the step team, and the cheerleading squad wasn't particularly diverse. And so at some point I decided that I wanted to do cheerleading. And it was really fascinating, you know, how it all came about, how I sort of figured out how to make the squad. I made the squad, and then I dealt with some pretty harsh social repercussions. People, you know, I remember practice after practice, and, you know, you'd have the silent treatment from some people. So, you know, in hindsight, I remember that we were all just very young, but it was interesting.
Was it? I mean, how intense was that? Again, you talked about it not being a written rule, and yet this social understanding, once you had decided to transgress, mm-hmm. you paid a price.
Absolutely. And it was hard. I mean, in high school, I think a lot of my friends were getting a little sick of me. And, you know, I remember one year in my yearbook, someone wrote something like, "Another year comes to an end. Another year of you doing better than everybody else." And, you know, I think oftentimes those things were said sort of tongue in cheek. Yeah. But as someone who, you know, I wasn't cocky or arrogant. I really did want to be friendly and you know, and just enjoy myself and try new things. It was a little challenging.
Anybody listening to this can hear some of the normal social dynamics of high school, right? This is the kind of thing that goes on. Normal jealousies. You excel in too much, and pretty soon people are going to figure out ways to get at you. And then there are these other dynamics, these racial dynamics that have mm-hmm. been built into southern counties for a long time. The laws have changed, but that's not the way we do things here.
Absolutely.
Right? And they all get sort of so deeply integrated that I think your story really illustrates something that's not as easy to tell through political science tracts mm-hmm. or through news reporting, the way in which this is so deeply integrated into normal, you know, social life.
Absolutely. And I mean, one could find alternative explanations for some of these trends. So the fact that the cheerleading squad was maybe not particularly diverse. Well, if you have dynamics where it requires a great deal of time outside of the normal school hours, if you have two parents or one parent who's working and you can't get transportation, you know, 4 days a week, 2 hours after the buses have gone. I mean, things grappling with the transportation, even the cost. I'm almost positive that I was the only squad member who was paying for everything out of her own pocket. I mean, I earned the money for the uniform rental and the shoes and all that. And so one of the responsibilities, a very important task, was to provide snacks for the the football players during the football season. So every other night.
The cheerleaders had to provide snacks for the football
players? Yes, and I felt like they should be providing snacks for me, you know, because I'm out there freezing, jumping around. And so here I am taking my hard-earned CC's money and buying cookies and brownies and all that. It was, you know, and I remember protesting it a bit. So it was interesting. I think whatever my presence on the squad infused at least some level of a new social consciousness among the mothers of the team and the coaches, which was fun.
And probably some of the best snacks on the team because you've got a discount from CC's and no doubt that played a part of it.
You know, I like to think that in hindsight, I really think it was something like Little Debbie's. My poor players. It was, yeah. Hey, I dropped the ball there.
The sugar was just fine. So while maybe some of your classmates were a little bit jealous, there were people on the outside world who did see things in you. You ended up managing a statewide political campaign before you left high school.
I did. And that was perhaps one of my greatest experiences in terms of political learning. So when I was in high school, I had the great fortune of being involved with the gifted program for my county. And so one of the sort of capstone opportunities we had in high school was to do an internship. So I got very lucky and was able to intern for a woman named Mary Squires, who was a representative in the state house. And she was just this dynamo, just a really interesting person. And, she was also a single mom and just a fascinating role model and just a huge character, one of those larger than life people. And as a result, I did some research for Mary. I did education policy research, which sort of augured well for what I would do career-wise long term. But as a result of my work, toward the end of the internship, she asked if I might be interested in serving as the manager for her state Senate campaign. And I mean, boy, would I. And so it was just this fascinating experience where I did a lot of phone banking. And
experience after the fact, but how much experience did you have before? I mean, now you're about to manage a political campaign.
Oh, yes. I mean, and I should say, as I think about this campaign managerial experience, it's definitely loosely defined. I mean, Mary she definitely demonstrated a great deal of faith in me in allowing me to take on that role. But it was really just the elbow grease. I mean, I was so willing to, you know, turn over the universe to make this happen. And so I think she appreciated my energy and the effort. And I was just I learned so much too, just sort of talking over issues with interested voters. And oftentimes I would have these very lengthy conversations with senior citizens who, I mean, took an especially intense interest in politics and government. And so I learned so much from all of that.
From the conversations, how did you translate that into the sort of energy it takes to get elected? I mean, you're having conversations. Maybe my question is, what did you do?
I mean, largely it was just trying to make connections with people and to help them understand the relationship between the people we elect into office and the outcomes that we get in society. And so, of course, as a high school student, some of these were very, the ideas weren't as refined as they became when I moved into college. But there was a lot, and I learned a lot from Mary sort of in terms of
framing. Told that that kind of stuff doesn't work, the kind of earnest appeal to people's better judgment. That went out a long time ago.
I found that it did. When I went into college, I actually, after sort of managing Mary's campaign as a college student, I did a lot of voter registration work and really working to sort of do my part to increase political engagement among marginalized groups. And I remember talking to people in, you know, housing projects, and you would say, "Excuse me, you know, madam, would you like to register to vote?" And she'd say, "No way, I don't have time." And so I remembered being sort of floored by what I saw as something that's essential to, you know, my being as a citizen. And there were people who really didn't see the value of it, but it became, and we started to test out different arguments. And so eventually I realized that when you make something about people's children, and so you say, you know, I understand that you're busy, but who you elect into the state legislature really has an effect on, you know, preschool opportunities or, you know, whatever education policies affect your kids. And people would stop and they would come and they would talk to us. And, you know, so, I mean, I really discovered some interesting connections between key political arguments that you might use to help people understand how politics and government matters for them.
Have you thought about that since? I mean, obviously, you're plowing new ground as a high school student managing this campaign, and now, you know, you're an associate professor in public policy, so you're writing about these sort of things. How it is that people, you know, we can go into some of those neighborhoods in under wealth and poor neighborhoods, underserved neighborhoods, and we find that voter turnout sometimes is low in those neighborhoods in places they're deeply affected by politics.
Absolutely.
We have to assume that people care about what's going on. Where's the disconnect? How is it not connected to the voting process?
Mm-hmm. I think that we have some pretty meaningful and important disparities in political voice. And so oftentimes, and in my work, I talk about feedback effects of public policy. So oftentimes, government programs send very clear messages to people about sort of who they are and their role in the polity, what government means for them, how important they are to the government. And I think that there are programs that systematically send messages that say, you know what, government is really not for you, and it's not about you, and it's tough, and it's complicated, and your interests would, you know, be better served if you just leave government alone. Mm. And so I think that finding ways through policy, of course, to send better messages, more inclusive messages to a broader segment of the population. To everyone.
Well, to everyone. But there are targeted groups, groups that may feel a little out of the process. You talked about the importance of the GI Bill, for instance.
Absolutely. The GI Bill was amazing because it sent this very clear message that, you know, veterans, you've done a great service to our nation, and we want to reward you and show our appreciation with this very generous, you know, funding for student loan, or not student loans, grants, you know, scholarships for college and low interest home mortgages and so forth. Oftentimes, if you're a low-income citizen or someone who doesn't have a whole lot in terms of resources to expend to the political process, your interactions with government might be reserved to or narrowly felt within programs like TANF, food stamps, SNAP, and oftentimes even little things like you know, some states have the cards that you can swipe, for example, that sort of help to deal with some of the stigma of using social programs. But some states have coupons that you have to stand in line and fill out. Or let's talk about the FAFSA. You know, that's the most, it makes you want to pull your hair out sometimes. It's very, the financial aid, federal financial aid form is very complex and it's difficult to navigate. And so, you know, there are things that we have through public policy that are difficult to navigate, that make us feel just sort of.
And it's possible that the way the program is set up, if on the one hand you're saying, look, we welcome these folks back, all you have to do is demonstrate that you've had this service and we're going to sort of facilitate it. Mm-hmm. If it's set up to screen people who are potential frauds, then you end up feeling like a criminal just through the application process.
Absolutely.
Because
right?
We're assuming that you're out here to game the system.
Oh, that's right. I mean, with the GI Bill, I know this great story of a man who was going to a party with his buddies up in Syracuse, New York. And at one point, his buddy's going to sign up for the GI Bill, and he's just standing around waiting. And one of the program administrators turns to him and asks, would you like to go to college on the GI Bill? I mean, it was just, you know, very easily facilitated. But then you have programs like, you know, TANF is the one that really sticks out for me. You know, you might have to go and sit in an office for hours and constantly prove that your income is below a certain level to receive benefits. Once you receive the benefits, you know, you might be policed and your personal life, you know, interrogated on your personal life in ways that, as you say, make you feel somewhat criminalized.
So that's where, again, these subtle, not so subtle messages, these powerful messages that aren't as obvious to us in the way public policy is written, have a powerful effect on how people approach the political process and whether they feel included in it or excluded from it.
Absolutely.
I want to get us to the so we've talked about politics. Clearly, you're interested in politics, and we've probed some of your deep thoughts and writing. And you were a contestant in the Miss University of Georgia.
Yes, I was.
Contest,
which
and in fact, you won.
I did.
Spoiler
alert. The second time, though. So it was definitely an uphill battle. So I think of myself, if I had any rebellion as a teenager, it was really in just being totally okay with being myself. My rebellion was in my consistency. And so I've always been extremely nerdy and extremely bookish. But I sort of competitive as a kid. And I remember one day, and I also have this really keen sense of sort of, you know, I don't like bullying. I don't like things that are unfair. And so I remember one morning very early, I was on my way home from a class, and it was, I think, an 8 a.m. class at UGA. So I'm on the shuttle, and there are maybe three or four of us on the shuttle. And they used to have these really large posters on the buses that advertise upcoming events and, you know, anything. And I was sitting beneath a poster for the Miss University of Georgia pageant. And so these two young women are sitting across from me, two African-American young women. And so one woman turns to her friend and she asks, "Hey, are you going to do the Miss UGA pageant?" And her friend looks horrified and she turns back to her and she's like, "No, no way." And so her friend asks, "Well, why not? You know, it's coming up." And she says, "Because black girls don't do Miss UGA. You have to do Miss Black UGA." And so I'm sure that I was probably pretending to read a book or something, and I had some sort of like spasm of surprise. And I just remembered being astonished that in 2003, this conversation took place. So, of course, I went home and I did some researching. And I went to the program's website and, you know, based on the pictures that were posted, there wasn't much apparent diversity because, you never really know mm-hmm. people's backgrounds. And so I started to do some additional research. I talked to my friends and get a sense, and people would say, "Oh, yeah, no, you know, this is widely known, you know, on campus. This is just, you know, not really what you do." They actually created the Miss Black UGA pageant to create an opportunity for black women to do this. And I was just astonished. And I decided then and there that I would actually change things.
And you did. And we'll find out more as my conversation with Deandra Rose continues, professor of public policy at Duke, who studies landmark education programs like Pell Grants and Title IX. Our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Deandra Rose, a Duke public policy professor and a real go-getter from an early age. We're talking about your decision based on an overheard conversation, the black girls don't do the Miss University of Georgia pageant, and so, oh, yes, I will. Tell me more about the research. I'm imagining you researching this beauty pageant.
Oh, yes. I went to the library. You know, I went to the stacks. And because I was thinking, you know, Deandra, don't get ahead of yourself. You know, maybe there's someone who's – there were some gaps in the online photos. So I'm thinking maybe one of those missing pictures, you know, fails to complete the story. People have misconceptions. So I went to the stacks, and I remember leafing through yearbook after yearbook and, again, could not, you know, surmise that there was any real diversity going on. And so I'm thinking, you know, it's on one hand, I don't know. I really think it was there were two things. Like, one, the fact that Miss University of Georgia provided a face of the university. So she is one of the official hosts of the institution. And so the idea that an entire group of people are excluded from this opportunity or feel excluded from the opportunity, whether they really were or were not, I thought was really important. And then there's also the fact that this program came with hefty scholarship dollars. And as someone who was definitely grappling with the challenge of paying for college, I was the recipient of a Hope Scholarship, which was wonderful. It covered all of my tuition and fees. But in terms of living expenses, I was working many jobs and being creative. So I'm thinking, you know, the political history here of this program, the scholarship opportunity, it was just irresistible. So I started to sort of plot my attack on this program. And so, of course, the first thing you want to do is to go see the show. And so I'm thinking, I've got to go scope it out. So I go to the Miss University of Georgia pageant. I think it was Miss UGA 2003. I'm sitting in the audience. And I remember thinking, you know, I think I can do this. You know, it was tough. But there's nothing like also amateur talent to make you feel really amused, but then also good about yourself.
Confident, yeah.
And so, I mean, but that's also really, really fun. Of course, you have people who have like professional level talents who are amazing, but you know, you also get every now and then some interesting singers. So I went to scope it out the first year. So then for Miss University of Georgia 2004, I entered. And so talent for me, and I joke about talent only as someone who's equally challenged by that category, or I was. And I was just, I hadn't played violin in years. And, you know, I come from this long line of amazing singers. And so my family says, oh, you know, you should sing, you should sing. So somehow I took the advice and I sang. And I'm not a great singer. I'm a great actress, so I could, you know, I think I did some rendition of Natalie Cole's L-O-V-E. It was very jazzy, so maybe I distracted them with my you know, dazzling display of, you know, showwomanship or something. But I ended up placing. I placed fourth runner-up that year. And yeah, I was a little upset because I didn't win. I wanted to win, but there was some buzz on campus, like, oh my gosh, did you hear a black girl placed? And so I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is, you know, well, now I've got to win. So I've got one more year. I did college in 3 years, so I had one more year to do this program.
Of course you did. Go ahead.
And so I remember I entered a number of, so Miss University of Georgia is a Miss Georgia preliminary, which itself is a Miss America preliminary. Hmm. And so it's really interesting. And Miss University of Georgia is a very prominent program in the Miss America system because there are lots of Miss Georgias who were Miss UGA. Like, for example, my
Miss Americas who were Miss UGA.
Miss Georgias.
Oh, so, Miss Georgia. Oh, you go from Miss UGA to Miss Georgia.
Exactly.
Then on to the Miss.
Exactly. So my friend Monica Pong, who was Miss Georgia a few years before me, actually was first runner-up at Miss America. So, you know, really good track record for Miss UGAs. So I remember doing some other preliminaries just to kind of, you know, learn the ropes. And you really have to learn the ropes. I mean, it's such a culture. It's not something that you can just jump into cold turkey, or I don't know if it's cold turkey, but, you know, both feet in extemporaneously. Right. And
Warning taken.
Absolutely. And so somehow, you know, I realized talent was my weakness and singing was not going to cut it. And so I'd really been grappling with going back to violin because I'd always been really good. And so I remember I switched over to violin and I played Habanera at one of the local events. And I think I got third runner up in that. I'm like, okay, we're on to something. And so at some point I was having a conversation with my pageant friends who were fabulous. And someone said, you know what, I'm going to play Chartres, which actually a previous Miss University of Georgia had done. She played Chartres, this Hungarian folk song.
Oh, okay.
And then she transitioned sort of off the cuff to The Devil Went Down to Georgia and just stole the show. And so we're talking about that story and how, you know, it was fascinating. And my friend says, well, I'm going to play Chartres. And so I said, well, I'm going to play The Devil Went Down to Georgia. And I remember as soon as I said it, I regretted it because I'm like, oh my God, now I have to learn how to play The Devil Went Down to Georgia, you know. And but of course, I'm thinking, how hard could it be? You know, and so I found an awesome violin coach, and I think I had maybe two or three sessions with her where I figured out like any intricate passages. I played that song so many times, and I remember it was over the holiday season. We had a break, and I remember being at my mom's house, and I played it so many times. And I remember one of my siblings came in and was like, "Was that you?" And I was like, "Yes." And so by that time, you know, I was just getting it up to tempo, and I remember I was at my apartment in Athens, Georgia, and I played the song, and all of a sudden when I finished, I heard this thunderous applause from the balcony below my apartment. The neighbors had been listening, and I was like, okay, this is good. And so
Your sister didn't step on the violin this time.
Not that time. Oh, yes. I learned proper care for my instrument. It was like, yeah, I'm especially cautious with my instrument, and I still have that violin. That was one of the most triumphant moments, I think, was actually competing that year. And of course, you know, having been the fourth runner-up the prior year, I was expected to maybe place. But, you know, so I was sort of the dark horse and it came out of nowhere. And I sort of understand why people like football and, you know, a lot of these contact sports, because for me, pageants were a contact sport. And I remember some days, and this is horrible, I don't know how I feel about this, like I really am not a barbarian, but I remember having moments where I would, so, you know, my comparative advantage is interview. I could really handle the onstage interview questions. And I remember one time I gave my answer and then I went off stage and there was this line of girls. I think it was like the high school pageant or something. This line of girls, and they're crying because they knew the pageant was over. after that question. And I was just, and it was one of those like chest bump moments.
you felt good about horrible. The tears that you generated in those poor young girls.
Yeah. Exactly. Good for you. And I'm ashamed of that. I'm ashamed that I took so much joy.
Though you are still smiling. So this is the complexity of it all. It's enormously complex and rich and wonderful. And you won.
I won. And I won the talent portion. I won the interview portion. Wow. I won the crown. And it was really one of the most amazing years because it definitely changed my perception of pageants. And I think that I might have changed others, you know, some others' perceptions of what a pageant woman does, you know. And so I remember, I mean, for me, academics were still my priority.
Yeah.
So I don't think that I actually went to the homecoming game because I had exams. So I might be one of the few Miss UGAs who missed out on that amazing opportunity. But it was a fascinating year. It really was.
What you did, so you won the contest. What do you do as Miss UGA? I mean, take it seriously after the fact?
Absolutely.
I mean, it wasn't over for you.
It's a part-time job. Wow. And so you have responsibilities. You of course, prepare for Miss Georgia, but you also serve as a face of the university. So I remember being so excited when one of the Georgia Supreme Court judges came to campus and I got to be his host. And he gave this amazing lecture and he was one of the first African Americans to get his law degree from University of Georgia School of Law. And I remember during his talk, you know, it's a packed house in one of these amazing historic buildings on UGA's campus. And the first thing he does is ask me to stand up and recognizes me. And he says that back when he was at UGA, he couldn't have imagined that Miss University of Georgia would look like me, you know, and it was just a really touching moment and quite an honor to be part of the institution's history.
I want to bring you forward quickly now to your PhD and Cornell.
Yes.
Talk about that experience and that transition.
That was also an amazing experience. I went to Cornell after taking a year off. I worked in Minnesota politics for a year, and then I went to earn a PhD in government at Cornell. And I remember a lot of what people might term imposter syndrome when I got there. I mean, there was really this idea of, I know that I have what it takes or else I would not be here. But also just feeling really unsure of things because I didn't know anyone personally who had been through the graduate school process. You know, this idea of being at this Ivy League institution. One of my earliest experiences there was a mixer where the new students were mingling with faculty. And I remember one faculty person asked me where I'd done my undergraduate work. And I remember I said, UGA. And the person said, I'm sorry, where? And I said, UGA, University of Georgia. The person said, I'm sorry, what? And I said, University of Georgia. And the person goes, huh, okay. And then turns to my friend and says, where did you do your undergraduate work? And my friend says, Princeton. And I was like, oh, I love Princeton. And do you know this person? Do you know that person? And I could just, you know how in movies you see somebody shrinking?
Yeah.
I was just like shrinking. And so what I learned is that oftentimes when you're doing really challenging things, you have to block out the noise and the distraction. And for me, you know, I've always recognized that your work speaks for itself. And so whatever, you know, context you're working in, if you focus and you do the work, you can have the outcome, you know, that suits you.
What was your transition? Now you're at Duke. You started last summer. What was that transition like?
That's right. I love working at Duke, and I teach courses on sort of the politics of policy analysis and the politics of inequality. And so it's so nice because there's a great deal of interest on issues such as inequality. And one of my favorite things to do is to see these light bulbs go off in my students' brains. You can see these moments where people are thinking like, wow, you know, hearing an idea for the first time or thinking of something differently is very rewarding. And
well, you've talked about, you know, we've talked a little bit about these, certainly the way policies affect people, how they're received. And you in your own career, your very short career so far, have met a number of impressive women who've done this work. Tell us about Bernice Sandler.
Absolutely. So Bernice Sandler is known as the godmother of Title IX. And so part of my current book project is this idea that federal higher education policies have helped to usher women into or toward first-class citizenship. So by creating financial aid that has helped women to sort of grapple with this long-standing tradition whereby if families are faced with limited resources, oftentimes if they had to choose between educating a son or educating a daughter, families might actually educate the son because the idea was that if a woman were to get married and have kids, any investment in her education would be lost. Then you also had the creation of Title IX, which basically opened seats in institutions to women. So it made it unlawful for institutions to have gender quotas or to just outlaw or to exclude, women. And so in sort of getting at the political development of Title IX, I had the great fortune of getting to interview some of the people who helped to push it along. So Bunny Sandler was one of those people. And so she was an activist in the 1970s. And for her, she was also an academic. And she had this great story of how when she was interested in having a permanent position in her department, the department was hiring and she applied for the job and they wouldn't even give her an interview. And so she asked a colleague, what was wrong with my application? And he said, look, I hate to break it to you, but you just come on a little too strong for a woman. And so that was that. And so, for her, getting involved in women's equal opportunity in educational institutions was very personal. Birch Bayh, who was also the Senate sponsor of Title IX, was another person I had the chance to speak with. And he told me the story of his late first wife, Marvella Bayh. And Marvella was this amazing student, and she was president of Girls Nation back in the day and the governor of Girls State. And her dream was to go to the University of Virginia. And so she filled out her application, she sent it in, and they just mailed it right back to her. And on the outside of the envelope, they wrote, "Women need not apply." And so by the early 1970s, lawmakers had really grappled with financial need and, the inability to come up with the funds necessary for going to college, but they really hadn't dealt with issues related to access. And so that's what Title IX did. So while people associate Title IX with athletics, they're often surprised to find out that the policy has nothing to do with sports. It's just that there won't be sex discrimination in educational institutions and programming.
How has it become so associated with sports? What effect has that had?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it was when lawmakers were trying to figure out how to implement Title IX. Some of the debate, it's really interesting to look at the Senate record on this. And you have, I want to say, Strom Thurmond, who was a very pivotal figure in this sort of burgeoning politics. And at one point he asked, so Birch Bayh takes this regulation to the floor of the Senate for consideration. And so then you have people asking in questions like, well, what will this mean on the ground? What will it look like? And so at one point, Strom Thurmond asks, will this mean that the Citadel is all of a sudden co-ed? How's that going to look? And then someone else says, well, what about football teams? Does that mean we're going to share locker rooms and have women on the teams? And then they start joking, like, if that's the case, I wish I could go back to college. Mm. And just really fascinating discourse on this. And so I think that in that conversation, you had various interest groups that realized that this could actually mean some redistribution of resources across groups. And so athletic directors became very interested in trying to get a clear sense of what Title IX would do, how it would affect their programs, and interest started to just, swell up around it, and they just took off.
Fascinating stuff. Great conversation. Wonderful to talk with you. Deandra Rose, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you so
today.
Much for having me here.
Deandra Rose is a professor at Duke Sanford School of Public Policy. You can find out more about her and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski sitting in today. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.